This is Wage World, where we talk to the most interesting people in the world on KABF 88.3, the voice of the people.
You want to see how the other half lives? You want to see how we get around? Why don't you come visit me?
This is Wade Rathke. You're listening to Wade's World, a Voice of the People program. Welcome to the east side of town so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like here living in Wade's World, whether that's the east side of Little Rock, Greenville, or New Orleans, or on Acorn Radio in Nairobi, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay. Points east and west, where we are either rebroadcast or live streamed at kabf.org, wamf.org, or acornradio.org. A podcast will be available of this show on those websites and at www.chieforganizer.org. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world. And today we're talking to an old friend and comrade, Professor Joe McCartan, professor of history at Georgetown and director of the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor. Joe, welcome to Wade's World.
Hey, Wade. It's really a pleasure to be with you. Thanks.
God, we've only known each other, what, 45 years? I can't believe it took me this long to get you on the show. You know, 52 shows a year. I'm always looking for anybody, friend, or even foe I can put an arm on. Joe, I can't imagine a better person to be talking to right now than somebody who's looking at the issues of labor and the working poor, because we are in, I don't know what's going to be the name we call this, the pandemic depression. You know, if that the last one was the Great Recession, this is going to be something with an adjective. So what's the 38 million people on unemployment recorded, which probably means we're closer to 50 million unemployed?
That's right, yeah.
What in the world are we looking at from your perspective at Georgetown?
Oh, you know, Wade, it's, I think you make a good point. We don't even have a name for this yet. And, you know, in the Great Depression, they didn't name it as that at the very beginning. They didn't know what they were in for when the stock market crashed and things started to first go down. It took a while for the country to realize exactly what was happening. And, you know, in comparison to what we're in now, it took quite a while for the country to hit unemployment levels of 20% or so, which is probably where we're at this moment. So we're definitely into something that we don't know what to call it yet is. I think, you know, I'm a historian, as you know, and one of the things that is really clear in this moment is that it is historic. The only thing to really compare it to, I think, is the Great Depression. And yet, as I was saying, like, this is a sudden plunge, not going into a valley over a period of a couple of years. Like, we dropped off a cliff. And that's created issues and problems that are quite profound and we're going to be struggling with. We were already, as you and your listeners know, in a period before this hit of increasing inequality in this country and a labor movement that was really struggling. And, you know, the early indications are in this moment is that the most vulnerable communities are being hit hardest, and the labor movement is really taking a blow at this moment. Unions like Unite Here that organize the hospitality industry just being devastated. But I think we're going to see soon a lot of our public sector unions being hard hit by austerity. It looks like Republicans really want that to happen, actually.
Well, and we saw that in the Great Recession. I mean, it took years to see public employment start to come back after some of these problems at the state and local level.
I think that's right. You know, public sector workers weren't the first hit in the Great Recession, but once they started to get laid off and once austerity sunk its teeth into public sector budgets everywhere, that just worsened the Great Recession, made it last longer. And the fear, I think, right now is that a similar thing could happen.
I know in city after city, we're seeing you know, some forbearance on tax payments and, you know, utility shutoffs and this, that, and the other. All that sort of adds up. I mean, your point about speed, I think, is one we can't underline too much. I mean, we're talking 9 weeks. We've seen us go from what was almost full employment, record unemployment, at least statistical unemployment in 50 years, and now we're talking about something where, I mean, New Orleans, where I live, as you know, we've already got, a week ago we had 25% recorded unemployment, and it just keeps going. So you're going to have cities and states that are way over a 17, 18, 20 mark. And as you point out, it took a couple of years in the Great Depression before we got to those numbers.
Yeah. I mean, that's startling about this. And, you know, this is a thing that is a real challenge to organizers, I think, and to grassroots groups of the kind you've built over the course of your career, to the labor movement itself, because, you know, the challenge of trying to organize to deal with something that is so sudden is, I think, unprecedented and immense.
Well, and let's talk about, I mean, what has been growing in the labor movement has been public employment unionization. That's been the bulwark of the last several decades, and service workers organizing. And both of those, service workers are being hit harder than most unions right now. You mentioned the 350,000 member United Here. I mean, you're starting to see, you know, charity appeals. And mass layoffs, obviously, of their organizing staff. And they had been a very aggressive organizing union. And the service employees, certainly a union I spent 25 years in, some of their jobs are, I mean, their healthcare people are obviously beleaguered now. But they're not in a pretty situation either over the last couple of years. This isn't catching them at full strength. Who are we going to see lead whatever comes next?
Well, I you know, it's a great question. I think, you know, frontline workers of various kinds have, you know, been engaging in actions in the past month. And I think that's one of the more encouraging things we've seen in this moment. Mm-hmm. But you're right. You know, this great the thing we're in right now has hit hardest on two of the, you know, pillars that have constituted the strength of organized labor such as it was in this period, and that is the public sector and service employment. Service employees in many cases have been hit hard here, and they're beleaguered, as you say. Public employees, I think, are just, you know, now starting to feel the pressure of this because of, for example, just the absolute drying up of sales tax revenue in so many cities and states, which fund a lot of public sector services. So who's going to lead coming out of this? You know, I think that remains to be seen. But it's amazing when we look across the country and see, for example, workers like those in packing houses who've staged some spontaneous actions in, like, Tyson chicken plants and other places where there had not been much labor activism in recent years. And it could be that we see this emerging from settings like that. I think there are workers in this economy right now whose importance has been underlined and who themselves might see just how vital they are in a way that they hadn't seen before. I think of all of the workers now involved in logistics and transportation and the delivery of things. And, you know, what this crisis is showing is just how important they are to the functioning of our society. And if they continue to be placed in, you know, dangerous conditions, I think of the Amazon warehouse workers, for example, you know, it could be that we start to see activism among them leading to some work stoppages that could become, you know, significant. In the Great Depression, you know, the majority of workers never mobilized in strikes, but it was people at key nodes who were able to transform the environment in the 30s. And maybe we'll see something like that.
Well, I mean, we all grab at straws and, you know, the problem of taping radio shows like these. We'll have to live with whatever we're saying now, but we have a very, very good affiliate in France, and it's been interesting to watch and listen to their involvement with some of the Amazon struggles in France, where I would, in my perspective, it's not clear that how long it'll last, but at this point, at least French unions, which are not the strongest in the world, have actually, you know, been able to push back Amazon for $2 an hour hazardous pay and a voluntary return to work given their poor status. And I'll share, you know, this is even more dangerous, Joe. You know, whenever something, you know, a little personal thing, you grab it like a straw and hope it's a lifeline, but it could just be, you know, a passing gnat biting you. But I had to be in a hospital the other day for a simple procedure, and the transport nurse is carrying me down, and he asked me, you know, making conversation, going floor to floor, sort of, well, what do you do? And I said, well, you know, I organize community organizations and labor unions among working, you know, lower income. And he, you know, Charlie was his name, said, your phone's going to be ringing off the wall, because once we get out of this, I mean, the way these hospitals have dealt with us, and it turned out, the day I was having this procedure was the first day they were having elective surgery procedures at all. So none of them had been working for the last 2 months either. What a lot of people ignore is how many, as important as essential workers in healthcare and nursing homes have been in this crisis, a lot of professional healthcare people were laid off at other parts of the hospital. So he's saying, hey, you know, people are going to be jumping to join. Whether that's true, I don't know. But
well, you know, one thing I would say in response to that, Wade, is, again, using the comparison of the Great Depression, it wasn't at the worst moment when you started to see worker mobilizing and organizing really take off. It was when things started to improve.
Exactly.
So when things start to improve, I think that's the moment to look for activity. And it could be that, you know, that your friend is prophetic in that respect. Again, you know, who knows what will happen, but, you know, I would think that at the moment that things start to turn up is the moment when anger starts to supersede fear as the motivator of workers who, you know, start to see exactly how they have been treated.
Well, we have the famous concept of the revolution of rising expectations. We're talking to Professor Joseph McCartin, who is a professor of history and has written a number of books about labor and labor struggles and unions, and at Georgetown University. And he's also the director of the Cal Menowitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor. Joe, the gig workers. They, you know, they get a lot of attention. Their status is sort of an interesting thing to look at right now. I mean, their efforts to organize have been fledgling at best to date, and that's partly because of the nature of that. But now they're getting, in some cases, or they're supposed to be getting at least unemployment benefits for the first time. They're being, their status as workers is being elevated at least by congressional action for the 42 or so states that are actually willing to pay them. How is this going to change their status as workers and potentially their status as more stable part of the overall workforce, and perhaps even see some unions emerge there? What's your speculation?
You know, Wade, it's a good question. I think what you just touched on, the fact that for the first time, gig workers are able to claim unemployment benefits under the CARES Act is really an important development because, as your listeners know, I mean, companies like Uber have insisted that the people who drive for them are not really employees. But when we reach this crisis, we see that, you know, if people aren't categorized as employees, what's going to happen to them? So even in this moment, we had to recognize that these drivers deserve some of the same rights as people who are more clearly in employment relations. And I think that's going to have a profound impact on the drivers themselves, my speculation is at least, and on the way the rest of the country looks at them. It's clear that they are, for all intents and purposes, really employees. So I don't think we're going to go back to the idea after this that they are just, you know, entrepreneurs just out there driving as a, in effect, small business person. It's clear what their real relationship is to a company like Uber now. And I do think it's going to be something that reframes the whole discussion about who they are, what their role is. And I think, you know, my speculation would be it'll affect how the drivers themselves look at it.
I think it's also going to change the way the political world looks at them. I mean, you can look at the California case, I mean, where they're still fighting Uber and Lyft about classifications that have now been declared in that state as workers. How long are politicians going to be willing to pay unemployment if the employer isn't paying the contribution? I mean, the whole nature of the unemployment system, and it's so painfully ironic to read these stories about, you know, the trust funds and whatever and politicians controlling it. These are contributions made by workers and their employers. So at best, the politicians are stewards. It's not like it's a private fund for them to manage, but they're not going to allow big companies to not pay but collect benefits. And once you get the benefits, as you and I know, you don't have to be a professor of history at Georgetown. It's hard to take away a benefit once the workers have it, isn't it, Joe?
It is, Wade. That is history, and that's the way it's worked over time. Once people gain a right, once people gain a benefit, they're reluctant to lose it. And they'll fight to retain it, and it becomes politically infeasible a lot of times to try to withdraw it. And I think that, you know, we can say about like companies like Uber that, you know, there were a lot of Democrats enamored of this new economy.
Oh, my God, yes. You know, I mean, they were, you know, app fanboys and girls.
They were, absolutely. But now, you know, they're faced with the problem, how do we fund our system without beginning to tax these people to begin to support the infrastructure we need?
We're way outside of our lane, Joe, but don't you think this will affect the that's why I have a radio show, and that's why I invited you. But
you never stayed in the lane.
Yeah, I've got to find the lane. I'm on an 8-lane highway all the time.
You are, man.
But won't this how could this not stabilize a form of the Affordable Care Act, national health insurance as well?
I think, you know, one thing we've really seen here is that, you know, our system of job-tied, health benefits is really, really vulnerable. And, you know, so many people now have lost their health care because of this downturn. I think we probably have turned a corner when it comes to that. Yeah.
I mean, whether the benefits will be that much better or how, I mean, I mean, we've already suffered. I mean, in our union, for example, we represent, you know, some nursing home chains and some community home companies that, you know, are big enough that they had to provide qualified plans under the Affordable Care, but because there was no limit on deductibles, I mean, we literally had companies with 300 or 400 employees with one person who was getting insurance that was offered by the employer. Because if they're making $10, $11, $12, $13 an hour, what they were having to pay less than 9% benefits, and then $4,000 to $5,000 for deductible. I mean, we were having to say, "Hey, it makes no sense for you to sign up for that policy." And you know, you're in better shape, particularly if states have expanded Medicaid. But now that's going to become a problem that's unavoidable. I don't know how Republicans, Democrats, Independents, whoever, I don't know how they get around the fact that people are going to be desperate for health care and desperate for something that's, you know, the maximum unemployment benefits in these states like I'm in are, you know, in the 200s, 225, 235, 240. Hard to make that stretch out.
No, but you can't.
Nursing homes might be an area where we see some real improvement, though, for unions and organizations. Don't you believe, given that?
Oh, I think so. Given what we're seeing in terms of the danger that those locations are posing both to the workers and to the people they care for, I think, you know, the time is right to try to fix that really broken system.
And we have private equity. It's now a big player in things like nursing homes. And
exactly.
It's hard for them to avoid the fact the death rate in their homes is higher. But those have been people, home care workers and nursing home workers, forced to live on low wages for huge responsibilities for caring for elderly and other able people. And man, they're getting sick and dying in droves on the work side too, not just the patient side.
I know. It's frightening, really.
We were lucky to get a bunch of masks, some 7,000 masks donated to our union, and we've been distributing them over the last week or two. And even where we've forced some of the nursing homes we have under contract to provide more PPE and even some hazardous duty pay, and most of them, people were, our members were glad. We were supposed to get pictures taken. Joe, you'll enjoy this story. Well, there's no way to take pictures of union members getting masks without all of them wanting to be in the picture, right? Holding the box. So,
social distancing is
exactly
going to break down.
The only thing we had to promise in getting these 7,000 masks in the first shipment is, we'll send you pictures so you can send them to your donors, which were mainly gamers, Pac-Man and people like that who'd raised the money to develop these masks out of New York. And so almost all the pictures they were rejecting, because you'd have these 10 members with a mask holding the box that says Pac-Man, no social distancing. And, you know, it turned out part of what we were dealing with, and, you know, I don't know why I wasn't thinking about this earlier, is obviously at the end of a shift, even though we'd won the mask, they were having to leave their mask to go home to their families, but they were worried about having their families infected. So they were grabbing masks, not so much for work as to go home with.
Mm-hmm.
But what are we going to, you know, it's got to be, unfortunately, because those are reimbursed areas, even though people are going to recognize the value of nursing home workers or whatever, is that going to change legislative action that gets them more money, given the power, at least in the southern states, that a lot of these nursing home associations have? Oh, my goodness, I'm not sure about that, Joe.
Yeah, well, it's going to be a struggle, Wade, that's... For absolute sure.
We can answer that to almost every question. We're talking to Professor Joe McCartan of Georgetown University. Joe, you've been doing a lot of, I've read some of it, a lot of thinking about a different way that collective bargaining should work in unionized facilities. Why don't you share some of your thinking there?
Oh, sure. Be happy to, Wade. Well, you referred a minute ago to private equity and the role it's now playing in the nursing home industry. And that, you know, part of the thinking that, you know, I've been doing, and I've been involved with a bunch of union people and others who share this thought, is what have the long-term impacts been of the financialization of our economy and of the way in which work has been transformed over the past generation by things like gig workers? There's been a breakdown of the kind of economy that collective bargaining first arose within and to address, where, you know, collective bargaining emerged and, you know, really got into the, you know, mainstream of American life in the 1930s in an industrial economy when it was clear, you know, who the employer was, what it was to be an employee. And then collective bargaining spread into the public sector in the 60s and 70s and adopted some of the same kind of approaches that were developed in the private sector into the public sector. But the economy has changed so much in the past generation, in part through financialization and the role of groups like private equity. In part through privatization of the public sector, and in ways in which the austerity crisis has afflicted the public sector in a way that has basically left, you know, let's just take public sector workers, for example, in the position of trying to negotiate, say, with school boards or city administrations that themselves don't really have the power because, you know, Wall Street has become so powerful. Groups like private equity are so powerful that you sit down across the, from the bargaining table with public officials in many cases who just plead poverty. We don't have the money. We don't have the ability to address the things that really are part of what you're coming here to talk to us about. And so, you know, there's been an emerging idea that we need to break out of the box that collective bargaining became for us over time to be able to address the structural problems of the economy. And so, for example, teachers like in Chicago and L.A. have really, you know, begun to fight with the private equity and other interests that are that have such influence in determining what public finance is in those settings, and to develop an idea that we've begun to call bargaining for the common good, which means that, say, in the public sector, if you're a teacher or a sanitation worker or other kind of public worker, that you go into your bargaining not only trying to improve your own conditions, but fighting for the very life of the public institutions that you work for, and fighting against those interests, the financial interests so often that really control matters. And one key area where we've begun to focus on in this area is housing. And as your listeners know, in so many places around the country right now, workers simply can't afford to live in the cities where they are. And you know, $1 at the bargaining table is lost to $1.50 in effect rent increase proportionally. So if we don't fight for, you know, affordable housing in our cities, you know, what have we really won through our unions? And so we're developing an idea that to try to break out of the traditional boundaries of collective bargaining, to raise issues that need to be raised, and to try to mobilize not only union members, but their allies in their community, so that the union becomes a fighter not only for its members, but for all the working people of their community.
And this is something, obviously, labor community alliances that
exactly.
You, me, others have worked on for quite a long time. But you see some real traction developing on this area?
I do. I do. If folks followed the Chicago teachers strike that happened last fall, one of the interesting developments is that the teachers decided to make a key issue in their strike the housing crisis that was afflicting their members also, because it was becoming harder to live on a teacher's salary in Chicago, but also so many of their students. There were, you know, over 10,000 students in the Chicago public schools who were homeless.
Right.
And so the teachers decided we're gonna fight about this with the city, and they were, you know, accused of getting outside of their lane in that, and the mayor said, you know, housing issues have no place at the bargaining table here, but they decided that actually they were going to really fight hard for those, and they stayed out on strike longer than they would have otherwise, just to push those kinds of common good demands. They did end up getting a program to deal with homelessness in the student body. And, you know, they laid down a marker. We're not going to any longer just come in here and talk to you about our wages and benefits. And those are the things most likely to maybe divide us from our community allies. We're also coming in to defend the community.
Well, and you remember at the time, groundbreaking victory for HERE in Boston, winning housing protection as part of their contract, and they were, had to get congressional action to, you know, change the trust to be able to do it. So let's hope this makes a difference, too. I mean, we are just recently were approached by the big union Unite in the UK about our organization, Acorn, in England, representing all their members on their housing problems. I mean, so nobody can get around this. Joe, I've mentioned a couple of times, Joe McCartan has been our guest today on Wage World, a professor of history at Georgetown. You've written some of the better books about labor history in recent years. Why don't you share the titles so that people who are interested in this conversation can follow up and check those out wherever they have a local bookstore?
Sure. Thank you so much, Wade. Well, I have a co-written history of American labor called Labor in America, a History, that I wrote with my mentor, Melvin Dubofsky. I've written a book on the infamous air traffic controller strike of 1981 called Collision Course. And I've written some other stuff, one thing called Labor's Great War, which was about the early 20th century origins of some of our labor struggles.
Great.
I want to just thank you, Wade, for being such an inspiration to me over the years. And what I was just talking about really grew out of a lot of thinking I began to do when I first learned about organizing from you. And I'm just happy to be with you.
And we've made the whole show without me outing you as a former Acorn organizer in Houston as a youth, part of the Jesuit Volunteers. This has been Wade's World for another week, the world where the other half lives, where we talk about things you've never heard, and as Lucinda Williams sang, things you've never seen and will never forget. Wade's World is underwritten by the Darrell Foundation, a progressive force enabling change based in Little Rock, Arkansas. And as the song goes, we say it loud, we say it on the air, we say it on the radio. Until next week when we'll have another guest, this is Wade Raske from Wade's World. Thank you.